ഗുരവേ ഗൗരചന്ദ്രായ രാധികായ ടഡാലയ കൃഷ്ണായ കൃഷ്ണഭക്തായ തദ്ഭക്തായ നമോ നമ. ഗുഡ് മോർണിംഗ് ടു ഓൾ ഓഫ് യു, വെൽക്കം. ആൻഡ് ടുഡേ വി ആർ കണ്ടിന്യൂ വിത്ത് അവർ സീരീസ് ഓഫ് ലെക്ചേഴ്സ് ഇൻ സെക്കൻഡ് ടോക്ക് ഫ്രം അവർ സീരീസ് of radical personalism, the transformative reframing of experiential devotion. So today we will be speaking about somehow connected topics to our first one. This first, second, maybe third lectures will be kind of an introduction to the unfolding that may occur eventually. So before going to today's topic, as usual, for those who know me, I'll make a brief recap, and so we can somehow connect the thread and continue our journey in context. So last week, in our first meeting, we spoke about the possibility of upgrading one's membership, one's loyalty to one's tradition, in this case, upgrading my own loyalty as a Gaudiya by critiquing the Gaudiya Sampradaya, by offering some Pushpanjali, if you will, some flower petal presentation offering in the form of constructive and loving criticism. So we began that lecture by first of all sharing a few words about the concept of radical personalism, the broader notion behind this whole series, and how in the same way we have radical non-dualism, we can also have radical personalism. And we make some interesting connections with the very idea of Radhika, Srimati Radha, and Krishna himself, and how personified, how much individualized our tradition is, where we find even God himself in its ultimate, in the zenith of radical personalism as Mahaprabhu, wanting to taste all that he can be. So if you want to serve him, who is all that he can be, we should become all that we can be. That's the contract, if you will. So we are supposed to be representatives of that ideal. We're after chasing that ideal. Mahaprabhu himself is giving us the Raganuga path, if you will, the path of specificity. Again, everything is quite full of detail, if you will, full of specificity, full of individuality. And we are invited to embrace that abode, if you will, or that path to that abode. I also share a few words last class about my particular present situation in general and the awkwardness but advantages of it, and how that allows me to offer some particular vantage. From that particular vantage point, I can offer some words from this unique situation, totally unexpected, which somehow made me, as I mentioned, not fitting into any of the usual boxes, if you want to put it like that, into any label. Which, of course, when I use the word label and boxes, I'm not in the context of not being part of any particular presently any particular Gaudiya institution. I'm not with this implying that those who belong to a particular Gaudiya institution, that's just a box. No, we don't want to downplay that at all in that direction, but just I was referring to how others may try to put one in a box, because you may be part of a very beautiful spiritual lineage which has eternal prospect, but you can be part of that as if it were a box, although it is not. No? So it's more about how we choose to conceive those things. So I share some words about this situation of not fitting in any of these usual labels as challenging in itself for me, as challenging for those who want you to generally fit some label as a way of figuring you out, if you will. But anyhow, the point is that gives a very interesting perspective of the zeitgeist, the climate of the times, and think how things unfold, being an exception to the rule, if you want to put it like that. And finally, we concluded our last lecture by sharing some words about the idea of constructive criticism toward one's own tradition being one of the highest symbols of membership, how to show our membership, how to demonstrate, express our willingness to be part of Gaudiya Sampradaya. Well, critique can be an option, if you will. And we share some examples of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, practically every single member of our Parampara, going back to Mahaprabhu himself, and even that overflowing to other traditions, like Jesus and other personalities who somehow critiqued their own traditions, but loved those schools of thought the most. So again, that's one, we could say that constructive criticism, there is a place for that to be a symptom of one's affection for one's tradition. So that was the idea, not just to belong to a tradition by praising the past and living off, if you will, from our ancestors and their inheritance, but committing to the present and therefore committing to the future, and being willing to reframe whatever needs to be reframed and upgraded, not remaining haters, as we say, of the tradition, throwing stones from outside, nor being complacent from the inside, but trying to find a place between the two. So that's a brief summary. And today we will continue extending, unfolding the implications of what we already shared in this first class. The title of today's talk is Holy Shift, Upgrading Our Gaudiya Paradigm. So we will continue speaking about upgrade. The first class was also about upgrading my loyalty to my tradition. So there's lots of upgrading to perform. So let's go a little bit to the very title of the lecture, share some words about this notion of shift. Shift happens, as they say it, famous saying, among Gaudiyas probably now. And that shift has to be holy, if that happens in such a context. That's why we use the term holy shift. Another way of use of relating to that is called paradigm shift. So let's try to define some terms to begin with. And of course, I recently had my own holy shift in my own life, my very interesting paradigm movement of tectonic foundations, which of course also somehow further confirmed and further showed the need, a need that I already felt for some time, of course, of some paradigmatic shift happening not only in one's individual case, but in a more global situation, which of course, again, it all begins through the individuals. So, and I think that for me and for others with whom I have been sharing for a long time already, certain shifts need to take place for us to, how to say, to feel that we belong to the Gaudiya Sampradaya, that it is place for all of us in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And remember, Srila Prabhupada, we connected to this idea, he constructed a house in which the whole world can live. So this is not about only the size of the house, of the size of the room, or the physical dimension of the institution, of the building, but size in quality, size in diversity, size in, again, hosting capacity, accommodating diversity, accommodating nuance, accommodating necessities of the time. So all of us need to see certain shift for all of us to feel we belong to the Gaudiya Sampradaya, and we can belong in the most comprehensive way, not just fitting in, but belonging, which is a different thing, as we will see. But again, before going to the details of that, what's a paradigm shift? What's a holy shift? Paradigm is kind of a framework, conceptual framework, on the basis of which we kind of like erect and construct our way of perceiving reality, our worldview, basically, our cosmovision, if you will. And of course, a shift of that paradigm, as you can already imagine, has to do with an invitation from above, from truth itself, as we will take it, to rethink and to reframe, to reframe the frame, basically, to reframe the framework, to engage in a reframe work, no? Reframe work. So framework implies work. No, there's always work included. It's not just I have my framework. Work on your framework. Reframe work. So to reframe the way we use to conceive everything, because again, a paradigm means the way I conceive everything. Paradigm shift means open yourself to reframing, rethinking. And this is especially applicable in a school of thought like ours, which deals with a subject matter of study, which is infinite in nature. So how much you have to be willing to rethink, reframe, reaccommodate. There's no limit for evolution and expansion, so we should remain always in that space, basically, liminal space. And of course, the contrast of that will be someone who is completely addicted to their own paradigm, if you will, who is totally attaches that as the all-in-all, and is not willing to shift when that's necessary in their paradigm, and in that case, is willing to compromise truth for the sake of paradigm, quote-unquote. But actually, the real paradigm means a shift in paradigm. That's the real, nature of a living paradigm is that there has to be movement, there has to be shift. So the point is, if we are not willing to do that, whenever we encounter something that is not fitting our current paradigm, of course, but probably we know it's true, sometimes it's happened. No? You know, truth is knocking on my door, but if I open that door, my paradigm will be challenged. Maybe destroyed, to burned to ashes, basically. So sometimes we know paradigm is truth, truth is coming, but instead I choose to stick with my old paradigm, with my old lens, if you will, and avoid whatever changes are requested. And we adjust in a false way. Now we adjust the truth to fit the paradigm instead of shifting the paradigm to honor truth. So that's what should happen, as you will, because if not, we are just reinforcing dogma, reinforcing prejudice, reinforcing a false system, basically. And again, this is not about fitting or making things fit. We are speaking about belonging, belonging to the Gaudiya Sampradaya. It's not how the Gaudiya Sampradaya fits me or how do I fit it, but how to belong. Interestingly, you can even, I like play of words, as you know. Belong. No? You have to long to belong, but you have to become to belong. No, so that's belonging. This is not just fitting into some institutional framework or anything like that. And again, our paradigms as conditioned souls are built upon past experiences, mostly some scars. So it's if we are not willing to shift our paradigms, we will basically not develop ourselves. We will not evolve. We will not be all that we can be. But on the contrary, we will remain unbecoming beings. We have to become again. But we will become unbecoming means you are not willing to become all that you can be. So our situation will remain like stagnant and irrelevant, unrelatable, even for us, what to speak of others. And we know that this is not beneficial. Because, I mean, we can see if you choose to be in that situation, it's so, like, vibhatsa, invoke so much vibhatsa rasa, this rasa of disgust in others. If someone is totally stagnant and becomes irrelevant, unrelatable, again, a new paradigm shift is required. And the paradigm shifts are required more often than what you think. Now you may think, okay, this happens once in a lifetime. Now this is like the whatever midlife crisis. It has to happen when I'm 40 or 50. Okay, it's coming, it's coming. Okay, no more holy shift in this lifetime. And that's not very holy. No? But the point is that paradigm shifts come to destroy the template that is like suffocating us. But of course, the real question is how willing we are as individuals as a community, how ready we are to rearrange a new set of thoughts, new paradigms that will invite, again, real empowerment to all that we can be, become, and not unbecoming. So are we ready as a community to embark upon such a journey? Are we ready as individuals, part of a community, to embark upon such a journey? So this is the notion behind paradigm shift. This is like a kind of transfiguration, if you will. And again, transfiguration is generally a religious term, and it's a holy term, a holy shift. And that's present throughout our tradition and revelation. If you pay just quick attention, you know, Arjuna in the Gita, totally devastated in the beginning, throwing his bow and crying at the, as a baby. That's a paradigm shift. He's in front of the situation that broke all plans and all expectations. So Parikshit Maharaj suddenly put in a situation, you have 7 days to live. Wow, you are put into a totally different scenario. So this great narratives of our tradition, all of them begin with this paradigm shift, basically. And from that, they embrace that, they accept that, they open themselves to that. All our main revelation unfolds from that. Because of their deep willingness to go through such a holy shift. In different traditions, again, we see that. In Christ, the same. Interestingly, Christ began his teaching not with the classical commandments that and some Christians may relate to, but with a very interesting psychological idea, which is a concept that is termed as metanoia. Metanoia, which means to move beyond meta. Noia means the mind. To move beyond the mind, which is paradigm shift, basically. Change your mind. We had in our tradition the term mantra, which means to free your mind or to transcend the mind. So to transcend the mind doesn't mean that you stop thinking or you start to float and see color lights. It means like change your current paradigm. Change your mind means that. So mantra means that. Metanoia means that. Sometimes that word metanoia has been wrongly translated as repentance, interestingly. So it has been kind of weaponized, like repent, sinner. No? Like that's the change. But even substantial repentance means change of mind. A new way of thinking about your own life. Expose yourself to that. That's the starting point. And that's our service. Like once one devotee asked Lasya Marsh, what's my service? And he said, change your angle of vision. That was his reply. Change your mind. Metanoia, mantra, holy shift. So all the things are the same idea. So that's an introduction on the notion of paradigm shift. And there's another word to go to another section of the lecture, but connected, of course, which I like to also relate to the notion of paradigm shift, holy shift, which is the term sambandha. All of you may know this, but let's try to dig deeper what sambandha means. Sambandha. First, learn to conceive the concept. That has to do with sambandha. It's not just the concept, but as we will see, how we are treating the concept, how we are relating to, how we are incorporating, integrating that in us. So in our Gaudiya tradition, we have this term, which could be kind of synonymous or connected with paradigm shift, sambandha, which again does not only refer to receiving some information, as sometimes we may think of, okay, receiving some conceptual orientations and information that will teach me how to move or act, but it's also or mostly connected with the with the house, not the house like constructed, but the how in plural, house. Of that, how do I receive this information? Not only receiving it, but what I'm doing with that. How do I conceive the knowledge handed down to me? It's not so much what to think, as we say, but how. How to think about what I'm given. So sambandha has more to do with that, with figuring out the house first. and not developing a false sense of, I don't know, absolute certainty, thinking, oh, I have received perfect knowledge and now I know everything about everything because I have Sambandha Gyan. That can happen also. But Sambandha is, it's not about having the knowledge, but about what do you do with that knowledge. And not only what do you do in practice, what do you do in your own mind, how you are treating that knowledge. So, again, it's not only practice, but even before practice, applying something into practice, you have to make sure how you are conceiving that knowledge. Because, again, we have so many samskaras, we have so many paradigms, so many filters in our own mind through which we process reality. So how we are processing and digesting the information we are receiving from sacred sources. Before trying to wake up and practicing, if you will. So all of this is Sambandha also. So one more time, just in case, Sambandha is not only the information, but the tools to digest the information. What are the things that will help me to properly ruminate on this? It's not only the theory, but how to conceive the theory. So, but by doing this properly, which all implies a change of mind, again, don't lose sight, metanoia, holy shift. By doing this properly, what follows naturally of this Sambandha as an irresistible byproduct of it will be called avideya. The enacting of that comes after hearing, after conceiving, after processing my Sambandha, avideya, a lifestyle based on that. And then what follows then naturally as another unavoidable result of that avideya is that we call it prayojan, the ultimate fruit. So in one way, both avideya and prayojan could be another way of speaking about Sambandha, because the other two are like irresistible byproducts of the original one. But if you don't have Sambandha, there is no avideya, no prayojan. So in that way, no? avideya and prayojan have to do with that moment when Sambandha is in its proper place and it's like eliciting, invoking, just like a very organic like follow-up, if you will. Will be like, again, irresistible consequences of that. But it all begins in there, in this Sambandha, in this metanoia, in this change of mind, properly conceiving, digesting, understanding the concepts. That, again, for that to happen, we need to change many things in the way we relate to things. It's not that in the way I am perfectly equipped to properly conceive everything. No, that's not the first step to take. So, and of course, again, this is not as simple as we may think. No, it's not like, so what to do then, Maharaj? What was the formula? What was the phrase, the sentence, the magic? Give me the magic. No. If you want magic, that's Maya, basically. No, it's not as simple as we may like to think. We want to think things to be as simple as possibly, but that's not reality. Think that reality is simple or simplistic, that's the opposite of reality. So the point is, in order to properly embrace Sambandha, again, we have to deal with so many things that are in between Sambandha and us, if you will. So many layers of prejudice, cultural baggage, ego filters, dualism of any type, and whatnot. I mean, you have a whole supermarket of that. No? So we need to detect them, to deal with them one by one as a part of this Sambandha stage. As difficult as it may be, as embarrassing as it may feel to the ego. So in one sense, we could say all this series we are doing of radical personalism can also be seen as revolving around this particular way of understanding the term Sambandha. Like rethinking, reframing our approach. So some words about this idea of Sambandha, which I feel really closely tied to the notion of holy shift and change of mind. And all this go into to another section, if you will, go, and all these have to do also with the very fact of I mean, why we are suggesting all this? In one sense, all this has to do with the starting a movement. But don't let your mind go quickly to an external way of conceiving everything. Oh, a movement. Oh, Maharaj will open a mission. He will be a guru and he will construct a temple. Why we think everything external terms? No? So starting a movement is an inner one. The movement is always starts at home, inside. And if something happens outside, that's just like, again, a consequence of the internal movement. So this is all what we are here speaking about here is, yeah, it's a movement. It's about starting or continuing, developing movement. But this is an internal movement. What's moving inside of me? So again, all this suggested changes of mind, paradigm shifts, adjustments, if you want to put it like that, are not mere preaching strategy so we can reach more people and conquer the world someday or something like that. No, all the things we are sharing here are things that I feel we need to be in place so we can become better participants ourselves, better players ourselves. Not about just bringing more players into the match, into the arena, but how nicely we are playing ourselves the game. How can we upgrade our own participation. And of course, whatever we are sharing here, I'm not saying this is a formula for everyone to adopt necessarily. I'm not implying here this is the new world, Gaudiya world paradigm. Nothing like that. Again, I'm not trying, much less to create a new Sampradaya or Parivar, but just sharing some thoughts that hopefully may help all of us, or at least some of us, to belong to this movement in a more realistic way. Just not to, again, force our fitting in somehow or other by force or who knows what. So in that sense only, we can speak of what we are sharing as a type of movement, again, that we are creating. Or we are continuing to create. This is a continuous creation, if you will. Without beginning, without end. And again, it's not me who is creating, it's all of those who feel a need for a deeper belonging. Not just a force fitting in. So that's, in that sense, is a movement. But which type of movement again? An internal movement of the heart to begin with. Something has to be moving there to create some other movements. And that's how our movement began. We belong to the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Mahaprabhu is the original, if you will, volcano through which Gaudiya Sampradaya erupted from. No? And he created the movement. Mahaprabhu started the movement. Not an institution, not even a religion, we could say, but it all began as a movement, with his own movement. With those things that were moving him to be who he is. And as we know, the consequences of that, no? Of being Krishna into such an experiment, he was so moved, so ecstatic. And he was well moved in such a way, even externally, dancing, as we know, conquering everything on its way, that everyone started to follow him, to follow his movement. Everyone started to be charmed by him, and eventually everyone started to acknowledge his godhood, and gradually a whole ontology was formed around the figure of Mahaprabhu, about his radical personalism. He's been an embodiment of that. Gradually all these shapes starting to unfold. But again, it all began overflowing ecstatically and organically and mystically from his own heart. And that's how it should continue. And that's how it began. And for that to remain, to continue growing, that's the same, that the same paradigm, in one sense, has to be there, which is never the same at the same time. So in order for it not to languish, you say, deteriorate, the internal movement has to be active. Because again, Mahaprabhu's internal movement is what created an external movement that we call the Gaudiya Sampradaya nowadays. So similarly, as our Sampradaya began internally and it has its external shape, something has to be similarly moved inside of each of us. And whatever shape it takes on the outside, then that's the movement we want. That's the movement we need to embrace again. But it all begins from some internal eruption, if you will, following Mahaprabhu's way. And also movement, that's an interesting word, movement. Movement means movement. Something has to be moving. No? You cannot speak about the movement who is like a statue. No? Like something totally like in pause, stamba, paralyzed. No? For movement to deserve that name, it has to be moving. And moving again, it doesn't mean only external dynamics. And if a movement is moving, that movement in time, eventually in time, may change its shape because of its own inner growth and development. It will, for sure. And we need to properly honor those stages of movement, of unfolding. So yeah, I personally, as you may imagine, as I already said, I feel the need for considerable movements, considerable updates, and especially upgradings in our Sampradaya. And of course, I'm also aware that such a proposal may feel like a threat to some. It can happen. Such a proposal for change, transformation. Again, not rebel without a cause, not anarchy, but loving criticism so we can belong more deeply. But even if something feels like a threat, it's a good opportunity good moment to analyze ourselves and think why it feels so. I'm not free from that. No, all of us feel sometimes threat and fear, and it's an invitation to why? Why do I feel this? Why this is? No, maybe it's too uncertain. Maybe it's too paradoxical. Maybe it's too unknown. So it's a good opportunity. This type of experiences that we may feel scared or threatened, a good opportunity for collective reflection, introspection, and we need dialogue about these things. And I'm again just speaking here to a screen and to all of you beyond that, but it's not about me speaking. It's a whole conversation that we need to have as a group, as a community, and beyond, and to play the implications. We need to dialogue about this. No? Which are the implications of what we are doing? How, as a community, we are conceiving our practice, every aspect of our practice, how we are replicating the ideas we have received from our ancestors, probably without stopping to think, is this working? No? Instead of just copy-paste, is this working? What's going on? No? We need time to ask those questions, and we need even maybe more time to hear the answers, no? to be patient and attentive enough to hear the real answer. So... And of course, there will be some people who may not feel threatened, but who may quickly reply, everything is okay, everything is working. Well, look how many people we have here, how much money is coming, how expansive this particular branch is, or whatever, you know, whatever the case. But again, we know that the movement is internal, not external. Any genuine mystical tradition, or especially the path like ours, is all about quality first. Quantity will follow if it has to follow, and will be accepted. That quantity will be accepted only as a proper result of having quality in place first. Now, we don't want to accept quantity if quality is not first in place. If we are after quantity first in place, then we run the risk of losing quality. So, and by quality, I mean, of course, we mean so many things. But, I don't know, I mean wholeness, sustainable, realistic practice for each one of us, mature humanness in each of the members of the Sampradaya, sensitive relationships as a crucial part of our life and practice. That's at least the type of belonging I'm after. That's how we want to belong to the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Again, I'm not speaking for each one of you, I'm just sharing my own musings. I'm ready to pay the price for the consequence of that. But that's the type of belonging, at least personally, I'm after, of affiliation. No? In one sense, there may be institutions here and there, but in one sense, it does not depend on that. It's a non-group group, if you will. No, that doesn't even necessarily need to be a big gathering. No? It can be those two or three gathering, no? for the sake of deeper truth. We find this in many sections in different scriptures. No? Just one, two persons gathering together in my name, I'm there. I'm Vaikuntha. What's the verse? I'm Tisthami Vaikuntha, and so on. No? I'm not in Vaikuntha, Yoginam Hridayeshva, I'm not in the hearts of the yogis. When one of two or more of my devotees gather and to speak about me, to sing about me, no? To look for truth. So it's important to create that whole new level of affiliation, which doesn't have to do with big mega corporations, if you will, or something in quantity, but quality in place, even if there's the minimum quantity there. That's the real affiliation that will keep the movement in movement, if you will. No? So our hope is not in buildings. I mean, we are not against buildings. I'm not saying burn the church and demolish the building, but where our hope lies. No, our hope does not lie in buildings. Our hope is not in the staff, if you will. No? Our hope is in the transformed lives of people, basically. That's essential Vaishnavism. Saragrahi Vaishnav. That's what we want to become. That is what we built on. That's our foundation. Parampara means we are depending on the transformed life of our ancestors, and to build up on that, we need to be transform ourselves. We cannot just cling on to the externals. And by doing that, we will be able to provide a gateway for other people, by extension, to reach to the heart of the gift of our Sampradaya, of what Mahaprabhu actually came to give. That's the most comprehensive way of extending the actual gift, if you will. So anyhow, let's continue unfolding. What does it mean? We are speaking here about the Sampradaya, belonging to a Sampradaya. Let's continue speaking in the next section about what does it mean to belong to a Sampradaya? What does it mean to belong, to be a member of the Sampradaya? Although probably everything we are talking is about that. Well, let's continue analyzing that from another angle, if you will. So what's this Gaudiya paradigm? Because the subtitle of the today's lecture's Holy Shift is upgrading our Gaudiya paradigm. So we spoke about having a paradigm shift. So Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it's a paradigm of its own, as we say. It's a moving paradigm, evolving paradigm that takes a shape called Gaudiya Sampradaya. And the Gaudiya Sampradaya is a school of thought, as we'll say, but not only that, but a living school of prophets, as sometimes it's said. So Sampradaya, again, is a school of thought. There are many Sampradayas, as you know. And any real school, of this type, a real school of thought, should be a living school. But hopefully you also understand that, but I'm just adding the word in case you don't play out its implications. School of thought has to be a living school. And any really real living school has to be, if you are a member of a living school, well, hopefully you are a living person. And that's the only way you can belong to a living school. But living person doesn't only mean, as we say, I think last class, I'm breathing, no? I put the cotton here, still prana is coming, so I'm a living member. No, but living person in all that it entails. Again, radical personalism. All that you can be as a person. So what does it mean to be a living person in all that it entails? We can call that a prophet. We are all called to be prophets in that sense. So Gaudiya Sampradaya, if a Gaudiya Sampradaya is a living school, and to be a member of that you are expected to be a prophet, Gaudiya Sampradaya is a living school of prophets. Let me clarify so you don't get too intimidated by the word. That'd be good. For us, prophet may seem something else. No. So the word prophet, etymologically, the word prophet basically means someone who is a spokesperson, who is speaking for someone or in the name of someone, prophet. Ideally, someone who is speaking for God, ultimately. But even in an ordinary level, some spokesperson is a prophet. Imagine. But ultimately, this idea has been tied with the idea of the divine, because that's, again, the the ultimate ideal expression of a prophet. So a prophet in this sense will be an inspired, a committed, inspired participant through whom the divine will flow, basically. You know? And the person will be representing that through his words, her words, and reaching others' hearts, basically. You know? So somehow the idea is very close to the notion of a mystic. Now, what's a mystic? Again, we don't get these words scare you off, because sometimes we feel that's, I'm not that, that's people floating, descending from whoever, how, whatever, no? But mystic, a very interesting, realistic definition of mystic could be like someone who who has moved from mere belief systems, someone who has moved from mere belonging systems to actual inner experience. That's, to begin with, a very generous definition of mystic in which all of us can at least fit as an ideal. Again, not only I'm fit into a belief system, I'm fit into a belonging system, but actual inner experience. Again, we are all expected to have inner experience. We are all expected to be mystics, as Gaudias, at least on one level or another. Because again, the Sampradaya in itself, Gaudiya Sampradaya, is a mystical tradition. Gaudiya Vaishnavism is a mystical theology. So if you belong to that, you're expected to be a mystic. You're expected to be to belong to a living school of living prophets. Again, everything must be alive. Radical personalism is everything must be alive. If something has the potential to be alive and fully alive, don't neglect that, basically. So again, a living tradition is alive. As we say, it's a movement, it's moving, it's evolving. And we are invited to become a part of such a dance, if you will, of such a movement. And to represent it, not just by being exactly the opposite, becoming rigid, narrow-minded, stagnated, nostalgic, insular, fundamentalist. I mean, the list can be unending. But sometimes I invoke the contrast because that helps us to know what we are after, but know what we are not supposed to be about. But we are supposed to be sensitive to the needs of the present moment, willing to change, metanoia, to adjust whatever that may be required for the gift of the Sampradaya to flow unimpeded, organically. And that's, again, the job of the prophet. Don't lose sight of the idea. We are living school of prophets. A prophet is someone who has to deconstruct the system, if you will, paradigm shift, every time it's required. Again, not anarchy for its own sake, but whenever it's required, system needs to be deconstructed. And the prophet will deconstruct that. The prophet will lead us into sacred space and will show us the insufficiency of the old order. There was some old, don't make me like in conspiracy theories, new world order or whatever, but there's an old order that sometimes is insufficient. And the prophet's job, if you will, is to show us the insufficiency of the old order and move us into new sacred space. Again, I'm not saying every single person has to do this job, but at least we need a bunch of guys doing that for sure. Anyhow, so please do not misunderstand me. I'm not proposing here an absolute radical modification in every single aspect of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. As we say last class, Atma was eternal, is eternal, will be eternal, don't need to change that. Krishna continues to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead, don't need to update that. He himself is updating himself constantly. So we don't need to change those things. We need to change other things. But even if we say, okay, Krishna, as they say, Krishna, we don't need to change that, but Krishna himself, we could say Krishna becomes every day more Krishna. So Krishna is not today the Krishna of yesterday. Of course, he has no yesterday. He lives eternally in the present, but but he's constantly updating and upgrading himself eternally. So that's the point. It's not that Krishna is always the same. We are all, there is the constant of transcendence is evolution at the same time. It's becoming, not unbecoming. It It's an eternal becoming, not an eternal unbecoming. So the point is, if Krishna is becoming every day more Krishna, and we are supposed to serve him for eternity, we need to become ourselves more ourselves on a daily basis. We need to keep up with the ongoing dynamics in transcendence. Remember, it's not a picture, a movie in pause, Golok Vrindavan. It's constantly rolling. So again, all the things I'm saying are not about addressing the language we use to convey the teaching in modern times. It's also about that, for sure, as we will see. But it's mostly about developing a dynamic spirit to keep up with the pace of transcendence. No? To keep up with the pace of an ever-evolving reality, like Krishna consciousness, the ever-evolving God, an ever-evolving tradition. And everything is ever-evolving, so all this needs to be ever-evolving if we are to represent, again, an ever-evolving reality such as Krishna consciousness. It's in constant movement. It's a movement. In constant movement. So we could say that in this way, going back to the idea of the prophet, the job of the prophet, the job of the mystic is basically to keep up with the pace of transcendence. You can define that. That's a new definition of a prophet. He who keeps up with the pace of transcendence. And that pace of transcendence, of course, is ongoing. It's mysterious. And it's always happening outside of the comfort zone. Just for you to know. Don't tell me I didn't tell you. And again, such place may be scary for most of us. Again, outside of the comfort zone. Why? Because such people or such place, I would say such people, the prophets, those who choose voluntarily to inhabit that space, to work from that place, they may be scary for us. Or it may be scary for us, the prospect of becoming one. Because such people are, again, they cannot be bucked off by, I don't know, big governing bodies or big institutions. They are not compromised in any of those directions. The need for, I don't know, tribal approval, because their rewards are somewhere else. As we spoke recently, that's the profit of the prophet, if you want to make another play of words. It's grace, it's divine grace, something which comes from above. That's the profit of the prophet. If you want to call it profit, of course. And we all need grace as our main profit. So in one degree or another, if we need grace and that's the profit of the prophets, then we need to become prophets ourselves. And that will allow us to become members proper of this living school, Gaudiya Sampradaya. So anyhow, we share some ideas on what's a holy... Till now, we have still a few moments, so bear with me. But we have till now shared some ideas of what's a holy shift, paradigm shift. That in the context of the notion of Sambandha, just a brief recap. What's our Gaudiya movement externally, internally? What's our participation in such a living school as living prophets ourselves? So next, and before trying to point at some of the areas that may require upgrading, that we will see in future meetings, let's first reply to... to a possible question or continue unfolding that, which is why to upgrade. I mean, we are speaking about upgrading our Gaudiya paradigm, but is there a need to upgrade? And if it's so, why? So the need. Let's speak about the need to upgrade. I already mentioned, and again, I don't think it's only me, but and many others, the need for some real comprehensive upgrading. In many layers and reframing in our living school. And I share this exactly because I'm in love with my tradition, if you will, and not because of the opposite. And by upgrading, again, we are not saying let's stop chanting the Maha Mantra, let's cancel deity worship, let's dismiss the Parampara system, nothing at all like that. It's not that type of reframing. But the reframing is, again, the reframing is neither only connected to the packaging of the presentation of the things, it's also connected to that, but not only that, especially it's connected to the way we relate as members of the Sampradaya. We relate internally to all the things. How do we relate to every aspect of our practice? How do we process our own ideals? Take a time to answer that question to yourself. How you are processing your own ideals? So, as I already said, this reframing is not for everyone necessarily, at least not on the same degree, level, depth. And when I'm pointing to the Gaudiya Sampradaya, if you will, pointing, I accept that I'm, of course, I don't have an unlimited experience of every group, every nook and corner of the Sampradaya. So I will be sharing some ideas of in more general way, although I have pretty much detailed, comprehensive experience of many nook and corners of it. But the main focus will be always on me first, know what I need to change myself, and from there on, whatever can, if someone else can relate to that, as long as they feel it's applicable to their case, to their group, okay? Happy to be of service. But again, the suggestion for a reframing is not absolute. It's not like, here comes the reframing that should fit it with everyone. Because if I come with a reframing that is suggesting that everyone should fit in my reframing, how much of a reframing is that? You follow? It's a dictatorship. Just, this is a new box, everyone enters there. There's not even a second box, it's only one. So this is not the idea. So part of the reframing that we are trying to share and think about is an ongoing conversation. Again, nothing is fully played out. Again, it is to accept and think not everybody will fit in the same box. Everybody won't fit in the same reframing. And again, as we say, yes, last class, we may need to get many new boxes. And it's okay. Those people are not aparadis. Those people are not dropouts. Those people are not heretics or whatever. No, label you may like to add. No, indeed, one of the things I think we need to work on, even before going to any specific points, is like sometimes the overreaction that is there in some sections of our community to the mere suggestion that we may need to grow, to change, to mature, not only as individuals, but as a community as well. Suggestions like the ones I'm talking about here, of course. No? And somehow they find sometimes overreactions in the form of, again, quickly boxing people, putting them in a box, no? Labeling, judging, which again, no? Labeling, judging quickly is looking for a box as soon as possible. And remember, we here are after substantial belonging, not about box fitting. No, that's not me member of the Sampradaya, substantially. So, in other words, before upgrading anything, because we are speaking here why to upgrade, then before trying to upgrade anything, first we must understand the need of upgrading anything. No? Because sometimes that's not part of our paradigm. No, there's no need, the word does not exist. No? Upgrade. Shift, metanoia, sambandha, change. So we need first to understand why that can help us, probably can save us. How the very idea of change and upgrade is the very evolving life pattern of life itself. I mean, life is constantly in that movement. And after we can accept the need for upgrading, then we will be able to acknowledge those things that need attention, that need growth, that need maturation, that need life. But again, sometimes we are not very experts at this. We tend to go to the opposite direction. And we sometimes have a PhD in denial, for example. And so many other greats and glories in that connection. No? Denial PhD. As they say, denial is not only a river in Egypt. No? It's not denial. No? Denial is a way of avoiding those things that are begging for necessary attention. So we are experts in that. So it's important sometimes to go to, again, to analyze what we should not be, so we can have a glimpse of what we should be. And that's one of denial. That's one of the best ways in which untruth succeeds, if you will, in the world. By, for example, one of the ways, by disguising itself as religion, as we already mentioned. Well, that's the best possible mask you can wear, no? Like presenting like a good guy, gently, saintly person, and behind that, denial, hypocrisy, so many things like that. So, I mean, you put God's name in it, and you can just justify anything. Indeed, if you pay attention, many of the worst things in history were done in the name of religion, with loss of denial in between. So in this case, in this way, denial can be perpetually over-justified in the name of religion. It's perfect disguise. So we should be careful, because we belong to a religious tradition, if you will, to a mystical school, so we can hide so many things in the name of it, not in service of it, but using the glory of our school to obscure the worst possible things. So again, at this point, we need, as a community, as a tradition, and again, not only we, every community, every tradition, and individuals as well, but we need to comprehensively address this elephant in the room, if you will. And it's an elephant that the more we deny it, the bigger it becomes. It feeds on our denial. It's so big that we have a whole zoo at one point. It's not only an elephant in the room. Your room, your house is a zoo, and you have a whole herd of elephants, but still you don't see anything. So we need more voices shouting loudly that the emperor has no clothes. Still is naked, if you will. So the system requires upgrading. But again, first we need to acknowledge there is a need for upgrade. And the need, of course, begins at home. Homework, it's in us. Because if, in other words, that Jung will say, what you resist persists. No? That's how it works. But now it's persisting in a disguised form inside of you. That can turn pretty tricky. If you resist something, it persists in a very obscure way that you are not seeing, and that you may be justifying who knows in how many ways, having the perfect disguise of religion at hand. And if many individuals play that game, enter into that game of cheating and denial, and you multiply, put all of them together, you can form a whole community around perfect religious ideals, but which become even more perfect, quote-unquote, perfect in denying. Having such perfect religious ideal, they became even more perfect in denying and hiding layers and layers of, unresolved generational trauma, unaddressed collective wounds from the past, which has not even been recognized. What to speak of healing the wounds? You don't even know that you have a wound there. And so on. And all that gross dysfunctionality in the name of divine love. Perfectly hidden. And the whole community is on some level working, but on some level hiding all those things. Because on another level we are working, and it's working so nicely. So there's no need to upgrade. So we need to, first again, acknowledge those things, see those things. And because unless we see them, again, they remain there, but affecting us invisibly. So it's our, in other words, our own ego invisibly manipulating us. Now, indeed, the ego can be, by definition, is the sometimes called the unobserved self. Now, it's that side of you that you are not looking at, that you are not aware of. But it's unobserved in the sense also that because once you see it, the game is over. So it feeds up on denial. You follow. If you confront the ego, if you will, if you confront the self, false self, if you see it as it is, so we have Bhagavad Gita as it is, we have to have all this stuff as it is as well, everything as it is. So if you voluntarily confront your ego, that means to defeat it, because again, falsity relies upon denial and disguise. That's the way you can keep the show going. But whenever you face that, address that, acknowledge that, the snow disappears. The dragon disappears. And we should engage in that exercise voluntarily. Indeed, when it has been demonstrated even how your nervous system responds in an entirely different way when you face the demands of life voluntarily. That when you face them because you have no other option, by force of circumstance. Now, when you voluntarily invest yourself in radical personalism, choosing to do so, that creates a whole different set of paradigms, replies. So don't wait to do it by force. Don't wait that the condition of the sampradaya of your life as an individual gets as worse as it can be. Okay, I have to do something. No, that's not the way to reach apocalypsis, to wonder what to do now. Don't wait to do that by force, no? Because only because you had no other option. That's not glorious. But we have to prepare, we have to prevent, we have to learn from the past, because as we say, history repeats itself. No? A classical example in this connection is that of the hurricane, sometimes given. No? The hurricane could be said as an act of God, like adidaivika klesh. It's beyond our, we are not creating it. I mean, nowadays people may develop technology for that, but that's another thing. So a hurricane is an act of God, unpredictable, it may happen at any moment. But failure to prepare for that, when the necessity for preparation is well known, if you live in a place that that may happen, if you don't do that, if you fail to prepare, that's a form of sin, you could say. You follow? This has to do with this way of being proactive, basically. Preventing what can be preventing. Addressing voluntarily things that we know may happen. Of course, by saying this, I do not mean that we are in a hurricane state and we are, as a community, are in an apocalyptic condition. But failures have been there and still are, and of course will always be. Misunderstandings or out-of-date approaches or are still there and may cause, but some of the things may cause avoidable consequences. We may avoid some of those things in the future. Because remember, we are creating a future here. But for that, we need to take the time to acknowledge them, to prevent them. And for that, we have to address them, in all of them now in the present, as best as we can. And ask, in that context, the pressing question, that what's the future of Gaudiya Vaishnavism? You have to ask that question as uncomfortable as that may be. That's not only what's the present, but what's the future of Gaudiya Vaishnavism according to how we are doing things now. And if there is something in that future that we don't like, well, we know when to fix that right now. Because remember, Gaudiya Vaishnavism is a living tradition. So if something is living, is in constant movement, it requires renewal because of it being alive by itself. So we have to be willing to revisit, again, rethink, reframe the old so-called rule, what we call normal, what we have accepted as this is the standard, this is the rule, and probably recalibrate. We have to recognize our own tradition, recognition, have a new type of knowing what do we long to. Because if not, the opposite to that is basically, maybe sounds strong, but that's the case, it's insanity. Remember, what's the famous definition of insanity that Einstein gave? He said, insanity means doing the same thing over and over again while expecting different results. That means you're crazy, clinically. No. So be careful of not doing this, of just repeating a pattern, copy-paste, but expecting something new to happen. Of course we want insanity, but we want divine insanity, divine madness. But before getting to that type of insanity, first we have to avoid the avoidable insanity. So we have to do things differently if we want different fruits. And we need different fruits. It's clear. It's emergent. So, again, as part of that, just to enter into one last section of our presentation today, part of that, I think, has to do with understanding also our school, our Sampradaya, and also historically speaking, and the unfolding in historical perspective and the aging process, if you will, and it's unfolding, you know, like what I will dare to call it here, and I will try to explain that, the Kumar Lila of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, basically, something like that. No? So what do we mean by that? Of course, Kumar Lila means like the childhood exploits, like infant pastimes, generally applied to Krishna, of course. But the Gaudiya Sampradaya also has its own Kumar Lila, we could say, its own unfolding in time here. So if we want to understand our Sampradaya, for example, if we would like to understand that starting from Mahaprabhu, which is, of course, a valid way to think of, then historically speaking, our school, living school, is relatively young. It has only 500 years, approximately, a little bit more, 550-something. But if on top of that, you want to especially analyze the condition of our Sampradaya from the time it came to the West, it went outside of India. Nowadays, everything is westernized, so basically, if you want to analyze the Sampradaya from that moment, then we have a living school who is almost a newborn baby, no? Which was born half a century ago, less than a century. How much is that in these terms? So I'm saying this why, because we may, of course, in this case, we may justifiably say our Sampradaya is now going through its Kumar Lila. So it will show some particular symptoms. Of course, there are some specific individuals who will be elders and saints and everything, but I'm just speaking in terms of how a group of a community goes to different stages of development in time. So I think we need to understand that. We need to address that without any condemnation. Again, it's not something wrong to be in the Kumar Lila. It's not wrong to be a baby. Even we should appreciate the baby-like charm stage of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. like a set of parents, no? The parents will rejoice in their baby. That will be so charming. But also they will know what to do so the baby gradually evolves to, doesn't remain a baby forever, no? But evolves to childhood and teenage years, adulthood, eventually becoming an elder. That's the only then the baby stage is fully justified. If not, which type of elder you will have? No, so a baby is charming, of course. As long as the baby is charming, only it will be again. It will be charming, but also as long as an adult is taking care of the baby. Mm-hmm. You leave a baby without an adult. I mean, that's a tragedy. In 5 minutes, he's crawling in the street or doing any nonsense. So. As long as an adult is watching out, taking care, and appreciating the charm, but without also overprotecting the baby, we are not promoting here, what is Oedipal complex? Oedipal complex. We are not promoting that. An overprotected child, that becomes a monster. So similarly, to make a parallel, baby and Gaudiya Sampradaya, it's important to have an idea of how a movement like ours unfold and how much time does it generally takes to know for this unfolding and what to know what to do in each particular stage. Like a father, okay, this is a baby, he needs this, this is a boy, he needs this, this is a teenage, this crisis is coming now, whatever. So, but also without again overestimating its present stage. If you are a baby, you are overprotecting the baby, overestimating the baby. Oh, the baby's already an adult, all that he can be. That's an insult to the baby. That's what Prabhupada, as we said the other day, he said, overestimation is another form of blasphemy. That's not nice. So again, if we choose to look at our tradition through those lens, Kumar Lila of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, a new set of questions will approach us. Like, are we so enamored with our own lineage that we have this like naive loyalty that we cannot see any of the actual faults that are there present in our particular community. I mean, is that our stage? Romanticizing everything? That's not healthy. Mm-hmm. Or in case, let's shift, since we are speaking about shift today, let's shift the angle, and instead let's just to invert the angle and see ourselves as infants. Mm-hmm. And our lineage has become the parent now. So similar templates of naivete may be playing out, because we as members of the Gaudiya Sampradaya in our Kumar, own Kumar Lila will be belonging to the lineage by through immature affirmations like, my Sampradaya is the best. No, we are better than all other religions. My lineage is the best. My Parivar is the best. My mission is the best. My guru is better than yours. My temple presence is glorious. Which are all those extended forms of saying, I am the best, of course. But all the things that this is the best and I belong to the best, all of this stuff is acting to feed into our security needs in our Kumar stage, in our childlike expression, which is okay in one level. Again, security needs and survival instincts are natural for every individual, for every group in their developmental stage, especially in their early childhood. Of course, you are very vulnerable, if you will. But also throughout your whole life, there are security needs, survival instinct. It's okay, but they are potentially problematic when they can become delicate obstacles, when instead of being, how to say, like common sense needs, they become, each of these necessities turn into demands, and soon over into like over-idealized expectations that we start to project on people, groups, situations, and everything should happen or should remain happening in this way. And of course, all this, most of these processes are happening on a subconscious level. No, it's not that you are aware of that, but but many of these mechanisms are like prompting our so-called belonging to the Sampradaya. Or another charming but potential taxing aspect of the Kumar Lila is in Gaudiya Vaishnavism is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur will call this cultural baggage that we all carry. You also carry, I also carry, all of us carry. So those influences that which somehow arise from the various social units that we have been part of, and whose values as infants are probably we accepted that, like, how do you say in English, like indisputably, without dispute. Mm-hmm. We all have done that as child. This value, okay, this is what it is. This is my paradigm at that age. Mm-hmm. And again, please bear in mind, this not only applies to us as individuals, but also to our lineage as an individualized group, so to say. Mm-hmm. We can see the whole Sampradaya as an entity. There's place for that. And again, this is normal and this is necessary for a child. He's being informed by an early environment and take some values as without too much filter. But when from childhood we go to something beyond that, adulthood, let's say, each of us need to reevaluate each of these principles so we can still follow them, but now out of the clear understanding and voluntary acceptance, not just out of instinct, if you will, no? Not due to compensatory needs to belong or to, I don't know, divisive over-identification with my tribe, uninformed judgments. Maybe as a child you had all those stuff and it's okay, you are a child. No? But when you are an adult, you need to rethink, recognize all those same patterns and update them. So as an adult, individual or as a group, we are not expressing this, again, compensatory need to belong, over-identification, tribal thinking, cognitive rigidity. Does it sound familiar? So, anyhow, just as conclusion, just for me to clarify, I mean, please do not think that by saying all the things, I already clarified that, but just for you not to get nervous, I don't want to create more anxiety than the one I'm I'm already creating, and I want to create lovingly. I do not think that I'm losing faith in my tradition, or that I'm spitting stuff out of post-traumatic stress disorder in the context of religious experience or something like that. While saying these things, of course, may be part, an is part of my healing journey. I mean, because anything, I hope that whatever I'm saying is always part of that, of my own experience and healing journey, because all of us have so many things to heal. At the same time, these are not new things that I've never spoken about at all in the past. It's just that certain life dynamics, certain necessities in certain times and moments can become more and more evident in time. And again, life keeps moving, so we have to also keep moving and adjust accordingly. So let's not wait to our tradition to upgrade itself for us, no? So we don't have to do the work ourselves. No? That's not radical personalism. That's the opposite of it. And the series is radical personalism. So again, we have to be part of the tradition. We have to really belong to it. We have not just to be consumers of the product. In this case, Gaudiya Vaishnavism. It's not to be reduced to a mere product to consume. We have to contribute to the cause for it to become more relevant. And not more relevant to others to begin with, relevant for us to begin with. So that's the question. What's my part in the contribution? That question means to be in the parampara, to ask that question constantly, not once a year for Janmashtami during the day of your initiation when everything is collapsing, when everything is nice, but on a daily basis. How can I belong today to Gaudiya Sampradaya? And every day the question may sound externally the same, but every day will have a new meaning, and every day will have a new answer to that. So if you properly address such a daily question, I mean, wow, that in itself constitutes an exciting portal to address such a question on a daily basis. Stop feeling, and it won't feel like a threat to our faith, like we mentioned today. Some may be threatened by those questions. But if properly addressed, it becomes like a whole moment, or aha moment, they say also. We in Sanskrit have the word aho, a whole moment. Now we will have a glimpse, so much possibility, so much prospect lying there, so much necessity of service to offer, and how much chances of to offer ourselves in service. So that's the question, how can I offer in service? What's the necessity there? What Gaudiya Sampradaya needs, and how can I identify with that need, make that need mine, and that becomes my need, and offer myself in service. So let me conclude with one quote from Viktor Frankl, a very dear author and person for me, very interesting thinker, to say the least. And as you know, many of you know, recently I was reading his Man in Search of Meaning again. I don't know how many times I already read it. And he famously said there at one point, and I shared that quote the other day as well, so you may not be surprised by that, but be surprised, because there's a lot to say. So he'll say, it does not matter what we expect from life, but rather what life expects from us. And again, he walked the talk, if you know his story and his background in Auschwitz and so on. So it doesn't matter what we expect from life. And we have so many expectations from life, from everything, from everyone. Not all of them are so already so defined and clear, and everything should be happening in this particular way. But it's nonsense, all that, in one sense. The real question is what life expects from us. So again, in similar way, continuing with these ideas, is not so much what we expect from our spiritual lineage, from the Gaudiya Sampradaya, but what does my spiritual lineage expect from me? What does the Gaudiya Sampradaya, what does God himself, expressing through the Sampradaya, expect from me? So I leave you with that question for today's homework. Remember, every day, every week, we are having some homework, more in the form of reflection, introspection. So try to incorporate this important question. What does the Gaudiya Sampradaya expect from me? And how can I reply with my life to such a question? So we'll conclude here. Thanks so much for your presence. Regarding questions, I will invite you to share them via thread, and we can address them during the week, because sincerely, it requires some time for me to unpack all these topics, and all of us need time for then digesting that. So I will prefer to conclude the lectures here, and the questions will be addressed throughout the week. So we have also some dynamics throughout the week. So whoever has any questions or comments, you can share them in the respective threads via Facebook, via YouTube, and so on. See you next Tuesday. So we will continue extending this reflection in the next class, whose title will be The Collective Unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So since we are speaking about the Sampradaya as an entity with its own Kumar Lila, it has to have also its unconscious, individual, collective, shadow. So what to do with that? So that will be the topic of next week's lecture. Thank you so much again for your presence and contribution. Shri Gaudiya Sampradaya ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol Vancha Kalpataru Vishcha Kripa Sindhu Vyayivacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vashna Vibhya Namo Namaha Ananta Koti Vashna Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Hari Hari Bol.